And I thought we might do the publishing and the writers. Perhaps some of the more familiar ones.
What page are you on there?
Page 151.
Right.
I would have you read, perhaps, some of these quotes.
Right.
And then as I put this thing together as a broadcast, I would probably come in later with the name.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we pick out a few of these and I'll have you read them. Let's see, some of the...
Well, some, you know, if we can do publishing, like, I'm sorry, Mr. Kipling, but you just don't know how to use the English language, or require the name in the middle.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. Let's see here how we can do it.
And then others, you have these strange things. When Upton Sinclair dies, he's dead. When I die, I'm immortal. And then the guy who said it no one's ever heard of, Benjamin D. Caceres.
So why don't we do this? Start with page 152.
Okay.
Why don't you read the line for Lewis Carroll, and then maybe and follow it with who said it,
okay,
or where it was said, actually.
We fancy that any real child might be more puzzled than enchanted by this stiff, overwrought story. Now, this was in a review of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland in children's books in 1865.
Smart guy, smart reviewer. All right, let's see here. Why don't you do the one on Dickens?
We do not believe in the permanence of his reputation, and our children will wonder what their ancestors could have meant by putting Mr. Dickens at the head of the novelists of his day. Now, that appeared in the Saturday Review of London on May 8, 1858.
Okay, why don't you do Dickinson?
The incoherence and formlessness of her, I don't know how to designate them, versicles are fatal. An eccentric, dreamy, half-educated recluse in an out-of-the-way New England village or anywhere else cannot, with impunity, set at defiance the laws of gravitation and grammar. Oblivion lingers in the immediate neighborhood. This was the editor of the Atlantic Monthly in January 1892.
Yeah, about Faulkner.
The final blow-up of what was once a remarkable, if minor, talent. Clifton Fadiman, who wrote that for the New Yorker in 1936. He's still around, heading up the Book of the Month Club selection committee.
I wonder if Clifton knew that Faulkner won the Nobel Prize for Literature. For the... All right, let's see. I'm going to skip some of the less...
Monsieur Flaubert n'est pas un écrivain. Is not a writer.
Oh, yeah, let's do that one. Do that one. Do that from the top.
Monsieur Flaubert n'est pas un écrivain. Monsieur Flaubert is not a writer. That was from Le Figaro in 1857 in a review of Madame Bovary.
These are really funny. Oh, Herman Melville. Got to do Herman Melville. It's on page 155.
Right. Moby Dick is sad stuff, dull and dreary, or ridiculous. Mr. Melville's Quakers are the wretchedest dolts and drivelers, and his mad captain is a monstrous bore. That was from the prestigious Southern Quarterly Review, 1851.
How about D.H. Lawrence on the preceding page?
Mr. Lawrence has a diseased mind. He is obsessed by sex, and we have no doubt that he will be ostracized by all except the most degenerate coteries in the literary world. It was John Bull, October 20th, 1928.
Oh, how about Mark Twain, 157?
100 years from now, it is very likely that of Twain's works, The Jumping Frog alone will be remembered.
Henry Thurston Peck, whom nobody remembers.
That's right. He was the editor of The Bookman. Shakespeare quote. Quite a number of people describe the German classical author Shakespeare as belonging to English literature because, quite accidentally born at Stratford-on-Avon, he was forced by the authorities of that country to write in English. That was from the Deutsche Weckhof und Beobachter, which is the New York National Socialist organ in 1940.
Sounds like something the Russians would have claimed. Here, let's go on to publishing now and do the one on 159 about Kipling.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Kipling, but you just don't know how to use the English language. That was a letter from the editor of the San Francisco Examiner informing Rudyard Kipling, who had had one article published in the paper, that he needn't bother to submit a second. That was in 1889.
I had Styron tell me the story himself, but this is too good. The one about the Kon-Tiki on page 160.
This is a long, solemn, tedious Pacific voyage, best suited, I would think, to some kind of drastic abridgment in a journal like the National Geographic. It's definitely not for us. And that was William Styron, who was then an editor at McGraw-Hill, rejecting Thor Heyerdahl's Kon-Tiki in 1947, which became one of the great bestsellers. It leapt to the top of the Times bestseller list that year and stayed there for more than a year.
For some reason, I thought it was Styron who said, who in hell wants to read about a bunch of crazy Scandinavians, but it wasn't, huh? For some reason, I thought he had said that.
We checked it out, and this is what we got. What? But of course, since we're the experts on these things, we're probably wrong, too.
May I quote you?
Never quote me. Or Christopher Cerf.
Oh, how about page 161, Jonathan Livingston Seagull?
Jonathan Livingston Seagull will never make it as a paperback. That was from the publisher of Popular Library, one James Galton, who refused an offer from the Macmillan Book Company on the rights to Richard Bach's novel, which was a bestseller in 1972. Avon Books bought it, and as of September 1983, total sales were 7.25 million copies.
Is that all?
That's all.
Why, this Bach could live on that, huh? Right. I mean, he does live on that. He has a new one. He has a new one out.
I gather.
Oh, how about Scruples, 162?
Scruples is a ridiculous title. Nobody will know what it means. We've got to get Crown, that was the publisher, to change it. Now, the guy who said that, Howard Kaminsky, was then president of Warner Books after Warner had purchased the reprint rights to Scruples. And, of course, the paperback of Scruples has sold over 4 million copies. Kaminsky went on to become the editorial director of Random House, which is the parent publisher to the publisher of The Experts Speak. So it's kind of funny.
Why don't you read the second paragraph in the box, The World According to Garp?
The story is only mildly interesting, and it does nothing new with language or with form. Thanks for showing it to us, though. That was the Paris Review, The World According to Garp.
Well, that's enough quotes, I think. Let me ask you a question or two. What can we conclude after going through this rather lengthy book, more than 390 pages, showing what the experts have had to say on almost every given topic?
You know, it's hard to say because Christopher Cerf and I started out thinking that we were going to do a serious scholarly study of the experts. And what we found is we couldn't find any experts who were right. Now, we don't claim that the experts are always wrong. We're ready to concede that they're occasionally right. And as a matter of fact, there are people who argue persuasively they're right as much as half the time. It's just that we couldn't find any. So if you try to make generalizations from this material, we get worried about that because we know how fallible predictors can be. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, there are certain generalizations that we're comfortable with. For example, we discovered something we call the cluster effect, and that is when all of the experts cluster and seem to agree on something, then you know they've got to be wrong. For example, in 1948, Newsweek ran the headline, 50 experts unanimously agree that Thomas E. Dewey will be the next president of the United States. Wrong. In 1929, there was a professor at Yale named Irving Fisher who wrote, the stock market has reached a permanently high plateau. All of the economists in the country agreed with that description and forecast. And, of course, 2 days later was the great stock market crash of 1929. Then we have a big section on Vietnam where they just line up to predict that the boys will be home by Christmas starting in 1965. And starting in 1954, it was a French general who first said that he saw light at the end of the tunnel. Then many American officers saw light at the end of a lot of tunnels until finally, I guess, the lights went out and we lost the Vietnam War. So the cluster effect is one of the kind of key things that we look for. Another thing that you can look for in listening to experts or watching them, we have discovered as a result of our study, but I should make clear, we regard expertology, which we call this thing, as an infant science. So we don't pretend to know all of the rules that govern it. But we found whenever you hear the word fad, you got to look very closely. For example, in June of 1955, Variety, leading show business publication, said, rock and roll is just a fad. It'll be gone by June. In the lawyer for the Ford Motor Company advised the president of the Chase Bank at the time not to invest in the Ford Motor Company because he said, the horse is here to stay. The automobile is just a fad. Charlie Chaplin said that movies were just a fad, that people wanted to see real flesh and blood actors. There was an editor at Prentice Hall Books who, in the 1950s, said that data processing was just a fad. And Thomas Watson, the chairman of the board of IBM, was reported as saying that there would be a worldwide market for just 5 computers because he thought that that was a fad. So 5 home computers. He thought that was a fad. So that's a second kind of generalization which we're prepared to make.
What about fads that had never been characterized? For example, one that comes to mind is CB radios. Now, that was a fad, and that's out.
Sure, but the experts didn't call it a fad. So
no, they thought that was here to stay.
That's right. Now you got it.
The experts, conclusion is the experts are always wrong.
Then there's another. Well, we're not ready to say always. Christopher Cerf and I have a disagreement about that. He says that in courtroom trials where you get conflicting expert testimony, one of them has to be right. For example, in the Hinckley trial, Hinckley, the young man who disturbed young man who attempted to assassinate the president, well, we had in the expert speak 3 experts quoted. One says Hinckley was suffering from schizophrenia. The second expert on the other side says Hinckley was not suffering from schizophrenia. Now, then the first expert says there were CAT scans taken that show he was suffering from schizophrenia. Second expert says, I have studied the CAT scans and they show he was not suffering from schizophrenia. Then the third expert comes on and says, you cannot tell from CAT scans whether someone is suffering from schizophrenia or not. Christopher claims, therefore, one of those must be right. I think that's just a lack of imagination on his part, and there are 4th, 5th, and 6th explanations as to why they all may be wrong. There are things, however, there are patterns that deserve closer analysis by future pioneers in expertology. We just begun to scratch the surface. For example, every time a new weapon is discussed, or a new vehicle, heavier than air, flying machines are impossible, someone will say. The experts predict first it's impossible to make it. Then, once the weapon is invented, dynamite, take for example, invented by Alfred Nobel, the inventor then predicts that this terrible thing he has wrought, dynamite, will be the savior of mankind. And he says that because no one will ever want to use this weapon against his fellow man because he knows it could be used against him. The same thing was said on the invention of the submarine, that once the submarine was invented, if I could read it, it's a very powerful follow-up. Well, Nobel, my dynamite will sooner lead to peace than 1,000 world conventions. As soon as men will find that in one instant whole armies can be utterly destroyed, they surely will abide by golden peace. Then, the submarine may be the cause of bringing battle to a stoppage altogether, for fleets will become useless, and as other war material continues to improve, war will become impossible. Then the airplane is invented. And John Brisbane Walker says, as a peace machine, the value of the airplane to the world will be beyond computation. Would a declaration of war between Russia and Japan be made if, within an hour thereafter, a swiftly gliding airplane might take its flight from St. Petersburg and drop 0.5 ton of dynamite above the Japanese war offices? Could any nation afford to war upon any other with such hazards in view? Then along comes the atomic bomb in 1945, and this is what's scary about pattern analysis, because they predict that dynamite will cause the end of war, that the rifle will cause the end of war, the submarine will cause the end of war, the airplane will cause the end of war. Now you have Louis Montross, who writes in War Through the Ages in 1946, never in history has mankind been given more reason to look forward to the future with hope, for the blast which blew 19th century nationalism to pieces at Hiroshima may also have cleared the way for a new renaissance, a new era of cooperation leading up to the 20th century empire of the world.
That was a wonderful day.
That was, yeah.
So
this is a depressing field.
It's
study
depressing. It also shows that the experts are very adaptable. Once they see their initial predictions are wrong, they will modify the predictions.
Like the new manager was brought in for a new group called the Rolling Stones, and he said the singer has got to go. That turned out to be Mick Jagger. So he let him stick around.
You must have had your friends and your families working day and night to slip you ideas for this book, huh?
Well, yes, we did. And we also wrote to every member of the Congress asking them to send us examples of expertise, if not of their own, of their colleagues. And for some reason, a lot of the members of Congress preferred to report on their colleagues. Then sometimes you'd just be sitting at breakfast, and it would all of a sudden occur to you, hey, just a minute, Abraham Lincoln said, people will little note no long remember what was said here. That was the first sentence of the most famous speech in the history of this country, the Gettysburg Address. So just some of them just came, and then we would check out old textbooks, and we had a lot of fun.
Well, Vickers Nebraska, it's a hilarious book. It's the kind of thing that I don't know how other people read it, but I skip through. Well, the first thing I looked through, of course, was the literature. But then as I went through, I kept skipping back and forth, and every time I was laughing on the bus today. I was reading on the bus, and people thought I was crazy coming down.
The bus will never work, the expert said that. And they don't. I say, the bus will never work, and they don't.
That's true. And one thing you can say, without fear of contradiction, the subway system does not work at all. That's why I took the bus today. I used to take the subway, but now, you know, it's a 50-50 chance I'll get where I'm going if I take a subway. I usually get where I'm going if I walk, but I've gotten very, very lazy lately. Thank you very much for coming and talking to me, and I'm going to have fun putting this together.
Well, it's great to be here.